These advisory council members are mostly virtues. I assume that their duties usually don't require much exercise, because only Clifton and I aren't winded. I shouldn't judge them too harshly. A few of the women are over 150 years old. Not that anyone could tell by looking. They have excellent Adam technicians who keep them appearing middle-aged, or, in some cases, younger. Walking with my hands clasped behind my back, I gaze through the rosette framework between the columns that line the corridor. The soft scent of roses surrounds us. The formal rooftop gardens are also laid out in rosette patterns, mirroring the framework. In the center are interconnected bathing pools and ponds. The virtue stops abruptly when Clifton sums up his assessment of the threat level we face if they go forward with the secondborn trials. "So," Fabian Bowie replies impatiently, "what you're telling me is, although you cannot discern any major troopship shift or sword-soldier migration that would lead you to believe that the event is Othala's target or that of the Gates of Dawn, you still want to postpone the festivities to some indefinite date?" "Yes," Clifton agrees, flashing his most charismatic smile. I fail to see how Fabian can resist it, but resist it he does. "The threat level is minimal," he argues. "Othala is running scared. She's all talk. In any case, they haven't had enough time to prepare." Clifton frowns. "You assume they haven't been planning for months." "Why would they choose the secondborn trials?" Fabian asks. "It's a social event. Othala risks turning her people against her if she leads an attack. The same could be said for the Gates of Dawn. Killing innocent people doesn't win hearts and minds." "May I remind you that our social club was attacked in that manner?" Clifton asks. Fabian truly doesn't know how hated Virtues is by many of the Fates, by the Gates of Dawn, by Secondborns. Or maybe he just doesn't understand the magnitude of my mother's hatred. Regardless, he's being short-sighted. "What about the threat of a census alliance with the Sword?" I ask. "Bah!" he scowls, turning to me. "It's hearsay. Until you can show me a shred of proof, I consider it a huge fantasy that you've concocted in your mind." Some of the council members catch up, panting hard and sweating through their silken clothing. The Virtue takes one look at them and says, "Dismissed." Clifton and I turn to leave. "Not you two. You will join me for breakfast." He slips through the archway and out into the sunlight. Crossing the lawn, we near a tranquil pond filled with glistening koi. We enter an opulent gazebo made of stone, where a round table is set with delicious fare. Secondborns stand at attention, awaiting us. The Virtue takes a seat with his back to the water. Clifton holds a chair out for me. His eyes dance, as if he's thinking of a delicious secret. Once I'm seated, Clifton claims the chair beside mine. From his position across the table from me, the Virtue dives into the minutiae. "The opening ceremony," he begins, "is the perfect opportunity to present you, Roselle, as the heir to the Sword. As far as it being your first public event as firstborn, it couldn't be more suited to your particular appeal." Dread filters through me, even though Raikin already told me what was being planned. I set down the piece of buttered toast I was about to eat. "Won't it appear strange," I ask, "when my mother isn't by my side as I accept the honor?" The Virtue chuckles. "You've already accepted the honor," he replies, as a secondborn attendant refills his coffee, "the moment your brother killed himself. It will look stranger if we don't announce your ascension. You can't return to Swords for a proper ceremony at the St. Sismode Palace until you replace your mother as the leader. This is a compromise. Not to worry, though. Soon you'll become the Sword, and everything in that fate will be yours." Perhaps the strangest part about all of this is the fact that he's openly discussing the demise of a member of my family, who I would have taken a fusion pulse to protect only a short time ago. I once labored under the notion that only secondborns were expendable. But it seems that all value for life perishes in a power struggle. I'm not delusional, though. There won't be any tearful reconciliation with Othala. One of us will have to die. I'd change that if I could, but I can't. Nothing good will come from my mother's rule if she's aligned with Census. I shudder, thinking about Agent Crow in an even more powerful position than the one he holds now. "Are you cold?" Clifton asks. "I'm fine, thank you," I reply with a fake smile. "I'm glad to see you two getting along so well," the Virtue says with a smile of his own. "It makes me less worried about the future of swords. Salloway will make a much better fated sword than Kennet ever did." I choke on my water, slamming down the glass goblet, gagging and wheezing. Clifton reaches over and gently pats me on the back until I can take a breath. Nervously, and with a rueful smile, he says, "I haven't told Roselle yet about the engagement. I was going to explain it to her in a few days, after she'd had time to recover from the grief of losing her brother." The Virtue waves his fork in a gesture of dismissal. "She's a soldier. She understands alliances and strength. She's a Saint Sismode for Virtue's sake. You don't have to romanticize it. This needs to happen. Her family is on the verge of decimation. She needs someone on her side that she can trust." "She already trusts you. I see it between you two. Don't make her go through this alone." "Excuse me?" I gasp, wiping my teary eyes with my napkin, trying to regain my composure. "Am I to understand that you made an alliance on my behalf?" Fabian nods. "I've accepted Firstborn Salloway's offer for you. He'll be your husband, the fated sword. You'll be wed as soon as we can settle things in swords." He takes a bite of his meal and chews, gesturing at me with the knife in his hand. "You'll want to start trying for an heir right away. Your brother was an idiot. He refused to choose a fated sword and provide an heir. It would have kept the Rose Gardeners from becoming so powerful. Not one for strategy, your brother. Although they tell me that he might not have been able to reproduce near the end of his life. Whatever he was taking made him sterile." "How do you know that?" I ask defensively. "His autopsy was very revealing. We'll spare you the details. It wasn't pretty. I'm surprised he lasted as long as he did." "How did his addiction start?" I ask. "Do you know?" "That's a question for someone at the Sword Palace, I would think," the Virtue replies. I plan to pursue the question if given an opportunity. The topic turns to logistics. Clifton is to accompany me to the Silver Halo, where the opening ceremonies will be held. My introduction as the Firstborn Sword will take place as the competitors are brought to the field. While Fabian drones on, Clifton's eyes are on me, trying to gauge my reaction to the announcement that he's my fiancé. When the meal finally ends, Clifton and I stand. The Virtue bids us a good day, with a promise to see us both this evening, and then he strides away. I walk from the table with a piece of toast in my hand, feeling Clifton trailing me. The fat koi swim to the surface near when I tear off pieces and toss them into the water. Standing next to me, Clifton waits until I'm bereft of bread to take my hand gently in his. The contact is sensual, and my heart doubles its pace. My belly fills with butterflies. My cheeks color for some reason. It's still just Clifton. Don't be an idiot. "Oh, my swords," Clifton gasps with a soft chuckle. His green eyes sparkle. "Are you blushing, Roselle?" "I'm not blushing," I mutter. "You're blushing." I try to take my hand back without hurting him, which I so could. I could beat him senseless for not telling me that he petitioned for me. "I am blushing," he says softly. He puts my hand against his chest so I can feel his heart. It's racing, like mine. "You're going to have to tell me what you're thinking. because I'm back-footed right now, he says, putting it in fighting terms we both know. You're aching right now, and this is the worst timing in the history of the world. But you're not alone. I need you to know that I'll always protect you, no matter what. I don't know how we'll work out together, Roselle, but I'd like you to know that I want us to. Is this... Never mind. I try to lift my hand, but he tangles his fingers through mine. Please, ask me anything, he begs. Why did you petition for me? Is it power that you want? Because I'll give you power. You can be my right hand anyway. You wouldn't have to... Clifton leans down and kisses me. I wasn't expecting his perfectly full lips on mine. It scares me, the intense ache that his exquisite kisses cause. I shouldn't feel anything. It's Salloway, interfate playboy, in a league of his own, arms dealer, massive ego, unrelenting cunning, extremely dangerous, string of broken hearts, that Salloway. But... My pulse flares. My fingers clutch his shirt. My knees weaken. This feels like when I handled explosives for the first time. Formidable, deadly, like something is about to be destroyed. I step back, breaking our kiss. Clifton. But he pulls me back to him. I've wanted to do that since the day we met. You mean the day you asked me for private lessons? He groans and bites his bottom lip, adorably, before saying, You cannot blame me for that. I'd just been introduced to the most confident and poised woman I'd ever met. I thought I knew you. I'd been expecting the girl I'd watched for years. Nothing could have prepared me for the reality. You were no girl. You were a goddess. You had me at your mercy. I don't remember it like that. How do you remember it? My mother had threatened me with severe consequences if I didn't perform well at the press conference. You were an interesting thread in a terrifying web. The light in his eyes fades a little. I'm sorry. You shouldn't have been in that situation. It took me too long to tear you away from our enemies. Nothing about your transition went as planned. You didn't fail me. I reply, reaching up and smoothing the hair away from his eyes. His expression softens. I don't want you to be disappointed, Clifton. I care about you deeply. It's true. I do care about him. I don't want to see him hurt. But I know a union will never happen. If I become the sword, it will only be for as long as it takes for the alliances that I've made to bring down the Empire. After that... There will be no swords, no fates, no fate's republic. He'll more than likely end up despising me for destroying what he has worked so hard to achieve. Why would I be disappointed? He asks. I can't answer him honestly, so I don't. Instead, I change the subject. Are you as worried about tonight as I am? His expression grows grim. Worry is a wasted emotion. We need to instead be vigilant. The virtue is reckless for the sake of popularity, but I plan on making sure that, whatever happens tonight, we never lose the advantage. Do me a favor? What? When we're in power, and someone gives us good advice, let's remind each other to take it. We walk together, discussing our plans for the night. My arm tightens on his, and I can't help worrying about what will happen the day that Clifton discovers my betrayal. I refuse to feel too bad about it, though. The Virtue and the Rose Gardeners have been planning my crash landing right into their arms for far too long. But I intend to keep flying. Chapter 19. Zero Rise. Floating above the Secondborn Trials training camp, the silver halo gives the illusion of being hollow, like the one the Virtue resides in. It isn't. Inside, it's an enormous, bowl-shaped coliseum. Massive airships shuttle excited attendees to the venue. Glass gondolas the size of city blocks also transport crowds to the silver halo. I watch the spectacle from the safety and luxury of the Virtue's private balcony. This mezzanine is reserved for Clarities and their guests. 9 distinct balconies circle the silver halo, each named for one of the fates and comprising an open-air balcony, supported by Gothic pillars for the exclusive use of a Clarity and his or her entourage. 3 extravagantly large thrones stand prominently at the 4 of the Virtue's balcony, one each for Fabian, Adora, and Grisham. Directly across is the sword balcony. Blue banners with golden swords hang behind it. Normally it's reserved for Othala, Kennet, Gabriel, and their guests, but 2 of my family are dead, and 1 is glaringly absent. But that's not to say that the balcony is empty. Today is occupied by census agents dressed in formal evening attire. They're my mother's guests, which isn't going unnoticed by the masses as they find their places in the arena. People point to the sword balcony and look to each other, wondering about the unique spectacle of census agents in such a place of honor at the secondborn trials. The agents toast each other and sip from tall, fluted glasses as last-minute preparations are made on the field below. Streams of firstborns fill the arena until nearly every seat is taken. I remain at the back of the balcony, near the rustling silken white banners adorned with enormous golden halos. I'm hoping to avoid Adora. She hasn't noticed me, but then again, she might not notice much of anyone or anything. Her expression is dopey. She's not entirely present, as if she has been given something to subdue her. Clifton doesn't let me far from his side. I'm not sure if he's guarding me or if he just likes being near me. He wastes no time introducing me to the Virtue's guests as his fiancé. He knows everyone. Everyone wants to be his friend. Every woman who gets near him wants to rub against him. Delicate fingertips touch his sleeve. Smiles grow broader, more teeth, louder giggles when he smiles. I'm not sure he even notices. A diamond-faded production assistant interrupts a rather pointless story that the saintly bank chairman is telling us about his excursion in the secondborn training camps.
"Excuse us, firstborn Salloway, firstborn Saint Sismode," the assistant says. "It's almost time for Ozell's presentation."
He scrutinizes me.
"We should get you closer to the front of the balcony. Is firstborn Winterstrom here as well?"
The man scans his moniker, going over a holographic checklist.
"I am," Raken says from over my shoulder.
Attired in an all-black sparring outfit, he's lethal-looking, his dark hair tied back in a knot, his fusion blade, the one with his family crest on it, the one that burned me on the battlefield, in its sheath at his side. My finger grazes the small star scar on my palm.
"Do you have a Saint Sismode sword?"
the attendant asks me. He eyes my white sparring outfit, settling on the hilt of the fusion blade sheathed on my thigh. "I prefer a Salloway blade," I reply. The woman next to me murmurs, "Wouldn't we all?" Raken's jaw ticks tensely. The production assistant gestures to the front of the balcony, motioning us forward.
"If you two would just come this way, we're going to start soon."
"Go easy on the poor star," Clifton says, leaning down and giving me a chaste kiss on the cheek. Those around us laugh, except for Raken. Clifton's lips linger a bit longer than is exactly polite. "Show him what a sword can do," he whispers. "I'll wait for you down by the field." I nod. "Please excuse me," I say to those gathered around us. "It was lovely to meet all of you." As we walk toward the railing, the diamond-faded attendant gives me and Raken last-minute instructions.
"The sparring diamond will elevate from the field. It will latch onto the side of the balcony, and you will both enter the diamond. Begin your demonstration as the hovering platform makes a circuit around the arena. It will land in the center of the field at the conclusion of the demonstration. Do you have any questions?"
"No," we both say. Dune joins us. He hugs me.
"I'm proud of you," he says. "I know this is difficult, but you're strong. You'll get through it."
Some of the devastation I feel is assuaged by his words. "I know this is the beginning of a new world," I say, my voice hitching. "But it feels like the end."
Dune's arms tighten around me. "That's grief you're feeling," he says. "But there's joy ahead for you. You've taught me what happiness is, Roselle. Not the distorted version of it that the world would have us believe, but true joy. Having you as a daughter is the greatest gift my life has brought me. You taught me what love is."
I choke back tears. "I love you too, Father."
"We have a purpose now," he says. "No matter what happens, we endure. And we never stop striving for what we believe in."
Suddenly, trumpets blare. It's time. Dune squeezes me a final time, then lets me go. Spotlights illuminate the field, and the ceremony begins. Competitors parade through the arena to a hero's welcome. The applause is deafening. Clad in all-black fighting gear, the second-born men and women slowly make their way around the field. Some smile and wave, but most appear as though reality is setting in. Tears stream. Trembling hands ring in terror. A few pause along the route to vomit. The diamond-faded firstborn pop star, Sarah Day, attired in a glittering evening gown, sings a heartfelt rendition of "Stay Alive for Me," which her grandmother, also named Sarah Day, made famous decades ago. Firstborn sing along to the melodramatic song with tearful voices. A colossal holographic projection emerges in the air above the silver halo, like a domed roof of light, footage of past season's trials, highlights of the more gruesome deaths. A silver platform shaped like a diamond rises from the field, hovering up to the Virtues balcony. Raiken and I step onto it. Our images splash across the holographic dome. The crowd roars, but I don't react. I already despise my part in this. I vow to make this the last second-born trials ever. We face the Virtue, Grisham, and Adora, seated on their garish golden thrones. Raiken and I sink to one knee. When we rise, the Virtue gives us a limp wave. We face each other on the hovering diamond, and the platform begins its slow lap around the arena, hemorrhaging rose petals in its wake. I draw my sword and ignite it, choosing the lowest setting. Raiken does the same. From the first thrust, it's clear that my star-fated adversary intends to give these firstborns an exciting show. In long, elegant maneuvers that play to the crowd, Raiken wields his energy blade, and I am coerced to retreat using a series of high-powered back handsprings. As I come out of my tumble, he catches me near the edge of the platform. I ward off his attack and counter with one of my own. "When were you going to tell me," Raiken growls as our swords lock and our foreheads nearly meet, "that you agreed to marry Salloway?" I let him lean into me, and then I pivot to the side, using his momentum against him. He stumbles past me. "What did you think would happen when my brother died?" I shout back. Our swords whine and blur, coming together in epic clashes of molten energy. We stalk each other in a circle, looking for an opening. The Virtue wants powerful allies. We turn in spirals. Our swords fly together in sizzling swipes. Raiken breaks from me, steals himself, and then swings his sword at me in a two-handed arc. I crouch, barely keeping my head. Bits of my hair shrivel, burned by his fusion blade. I tumble back. "It'll never happen," Raiken pants with a murderous glare. We fight on, ever conscious of the platform's edge. I find an opening and take it, making Raiken pay for his crooked left elbow with a thrust that burns his upper arm. The fabric of his uniform singes. The crowd erupts in adulation. "Why does it matter?" I stalk him as he resets. "You don't care, remember?" Raiken attacks, driving me back. His sword arm is a golden blur, and I'm forced to take a burn to my thigh so that he won't reach my heart.
I wince, feeling the sting and smelling the smoke from my skin. I break away from him and circumvent his position. Lurching forward, I run at him, and Raken simultaneously lunges toward me, his knee bent. Our swords meet. I step on his bent knee, intending to wrap my other leg around his neck, but he avoids the takedown by swiveling and pushing me up and over his shoulder. I tumble to the mat. Ah, the crowd moans. We're now coming abreast of the sword balcony. As we do, I glance at the sword thrones, where three census agents, two men and one woman, are seated. I recognize Agent Crow, slouched, his feet up on the railing. His long black leather coat seems a bit warm for the occasion. An amused grin plays upon his lips. The kill tallies notched near his eyes highlight the blue of his irises. In his hand, a silver orb shines. I've seen its like only one other time in my life, on my transition day. And then he presses the button, igniting the fusion snuff pulse. Instantly, everything powered by fusion energy dies. All the lights go dark. Our swords blink out. Fear grips me. I tense, expecting the entire arena to plummet. It doesn't. The Colosseum isn't fusion-powered. Our platform doesn't crash either. Both must be the same magnetic technology employed in gravitizers. Our platform continues its slow hovering path around the arena. Since I have a Salloway Dual Blade X-16, I flip the switch and reignite my sword with hydrogen power. It glows silver in the sudden darkness. Anxious voices ripple through the crowd, and then a different glow begins to emanate. Silver light shines from the eyes of firstborn scattered throughout the arena. At first just a few, then more and more. Soon they're everywhere. Goosebumps rise on my skin. The silver-eyed silhouettes seem to be in a trance, as if watching something the rest of us can't see. Suddenly, they twitch, in unison, as if collectively possessed, and simultaneously hiss like one seething creature. Zero rise. Emergency lighting kicks in across the arena, and in the next instant, horrific screams break out everywhere. It's hard to believe my own eyes. Moments before, the entire crowd was rapt, rooting for me or Raken, but they've changed. They sound like demons screaming. It's as if they have their own language. The silver-eyed firstborns scream streams of words that sound like negotiations, but for what, I have no idea. My eyes are drawn to one man in the crowd with a silver stare. His moniker's light turns dark and assumes the shape of a shadowy zero. I see another moniker change, and then more. Like dark matter bullying light, black zeros ignite throughout the crowd. Then the deep, demon-like voices cease, all at once, as one. Then they attack. The firstborns with black zero monikers launch themselves at the others like ferocious beasts, tearing into flesh with their teeth, ripping open throats. Claw-like hands eviscerate anyone in their paths. It all happens in the blink of an eye. There are as many of them as there are average citizens. A chaotic stampede begins, but the attackers are horrifyingly efficient, disemboweling people with their bare hands, aided by steel claws that project from their fingertips. The monsters move in a collective wave. They pile on top of each other, a tide of bodies climbing up each other, cresting toward the Virtues balcony. Exos fire hydrogen-powered weapons at them, blowing pieces off some, exploding the heads of others. But the convergence continues until it reaches the balcony's edge. Sheer numbers overwhelm the Exos, and Fabian, Adora, and Grisham are immediately surrounded. Then the pack turns on Dune. He fights the first few off with a hydrogen blade, but it's futile. The monsters are not deterred by the deaths of the others. Dune can't fight them all. Their numbers swiftly overwhelm him, and he succumbs, falling beneath a pile of jaws and claws. They devour him like Majinos would. And then everything begins to move in slow motion. The Exos on the Virtues balcony are killed with agonizing efficiency. Each murder plays out in gruesome detail. Adora doesn't even flinch when a silver-eyed monster rips into her jugular with razor-sharp claws. Grisham tries to defend himself with his fusion blade, but the mob takes him down, biting off pieces of his face as he screams in vain. The virtue is the last one standing. At first, the monsters seem careful not to kill him. They slowly tear his limbs, one at a time, prolonging his suffering. Then they rip his head from his torso, and I snap back into the moment. Raken is frantically screaming my name. On every balcony in the arena, the monsters are slaughtering Clarides, their families, and their guests. All except for the sword balcony, where census agents are celebrating, toasting, smoking fat, rose-colored cigars, and slapping each other's backs. "They're Gabriel's monsters!" I scream to Raken, trying to be heard above the cacophony of demonic voices. "The Zeros!" Another crest of Zero monsters nears our floating platform, jumping over each other in a grotesque wave of bodies. Raken rushes the control panel of the hovering platform. We begin to rise, but we're not fast enough. The Zeros climb nearer. We only have my Hydra Blade between us. "You have to fight," Raken yells. I grip my sword, though my hand trembles. At my feet, fingers begin to creep over the edge of the platform. I slice them off, and the steel claws, implants extending from beneath the monster's fingertips, remain embedded in the platform. A woman's face looks over the edge, her silver eyes shining. I shear off the top of her head, exposing her brain, and see circuitry sparking in the rippling pink flesh of brain matter before the woman drops into the undulating sea of bodies beneath us. I kill everything that attempts to gain purchase on our small floating oasis, and Raken furiously works the platform's control panel. But the Zeros are gaining. We need to shed weight. Raken must be thinking the same thing, because he runs to the back of the platform and begins stomping on the machine that's spewing rose petals. The bolts bend with each kick until the metal casing dislodges. It falls from the platform, striking crazed monsters on the way down. Still, the creatures rise. Desperation shows in Raken's eyes. He looks at me, then over the edge. He takes a step closer to it, his shoulders rounded in defeat. He looks back to me, and the sadness in his eyes is the same sadness I saw when he intended to kill himself on the battlefield when we first met. "Don't you dare jump, Raken," I yell. "I'll kill you myself if you try. Do you hear me? You sticketh closer than a brother." "You'll be okay, Roselle," he says. "Take this hovering piece of crap to the training field. Find transportation. Get to Stars, to Daltrey. He'll know what to do." "No," I scream. "They'll tear you apart." "I love you," Raken says, inching nearer to the edge. "Wait!" I fling my unlit sword to him. Reflexively, he catches it. "Agent Crow won't let them kill me, Raken. He wants me alive." I don't know if that's true, but I'm willing to gamble. I know Agent Crow. If there's one thing I can count on, it's his need to lord his victory over me. It wouldn't be enough to let me die here. He needs to witness my suffering. A monster lurches up onto the platform, then several others. I punch and kick the first one that comes at me, but it's as if he doesn't feel pain. Another throws his arms around me, snorting as he presses his nose to my throat, sniffing my neck like a Maginot. His claws retract. "Raken!" I scream, struggling as I'm hauled to the edge. "Roselle!" Raken shouts, swinging the sword as more horrifying creatures stumble onto the platform. "Find me," I shout, just as the monster leaps from the platform with me in his arms. We plummet, but then I'm jolted, caught by upraised hands and cushioned like a fragile egg. I'm moved along atop the bodies, clutched and passed from one to the next, surfing over a sea of Zeros. Above me, the hovering platform accelerates above the fray of bodies until they can no longer reach it. I'm carried by the wave to the sword balcony and thrown at the feet of the celebrating census agents. Agent Crow breaks away from the revelry and approaches me. "Ah, Roselle," He beams. Right on time. The party is getting rather dull, and I'm ready to leave now. You're a monster, Crow. He tisks me. Is that any way to treat your host? He lifts his hand and places a small black disc to his temple. It adheres to his head, and a glowing blue dot lights up in its center. The horde of monsters surrounding me take a step back in unison. A familiar face emerges from the back of the balcony. It's Hawthorne, but it isn't. His eyes glow with silver light. My breath catches. Hawthorne, I sob. Agent Crow chuckles. It's no use talking to him when he's in Black-O mode. He'll never understand you. They don't speak our language, or so the technicians tell me. Collectively, they stopped using it a long time ago. It's barely above gibberish to them. He's a new conversion, but he has all their technology embedded in his brain now. And, of course, I can use that technology to make him do whatever I want. Hawthorne stalks toward me. His eyes don't show an inkling of recognition. I thrust out my hands to stop him, but he winds back and punches me in the stomach. Hawthorne! I gasp in utter despair. And now I know I was right. Agent Crow won't kill me, even if I beg him to. He reaches out and lifts my chin so that I meet his eyes. Welcome to the future, Roselle. We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Traitor Born by Amy A. Bartol. Performed by Kate Reinders. Engineered by Stephen Jacoby. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.